Yo.
Okay, question time.
Ask and you may receive.
Imagine you have endless money. How would you climate proof your home?
I have no idea how to climate proof. I'll simply have ACs in every room.
Why just ACs?
We have only two weathers. It's either hot or it's raining.
But what about flooding? If you had endless money, would you buy a boat?
If the water is deep enough that you have to use a boat, then I'll die because I don't know how to swim.
But you can buy life jackets now and just float around until the water recedes.
Float around, wait for crocodiles to come and eat you up or get stung by poisonous insects. No, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
If you listened to the previous episode, you know that this is part 2 of a mini-series. If you skipped part 1, I highly recommend that you hit pause and go and listen to that episode first. It will set up context for what we will talk about today. But if you don't like being told what to do, you are still welcome. And here's a quick recap. In part 1, we explored how you can pick a climate-safe location for your home, what it would take to make climate predictions for different neighborhoods of your city, so you can compare locations when you're out trying to buy or rent a house. Experts also told us what the consequences of being able to pick and choose can be. Now for part 2. In this episode, we will talk about a future where choosing a climate-safe location is out of the question. Maybe you can't afford to move somewhere else, or it's a job you can't leave, or you've already built a home with love and care over decades that you don't want to just abandon. Or maybe there's no perfectly safe location anywhere. How do you then ensure that no matter what the neighborhood in your city, everyone gets to stay safe when weather extremes hit us? Welcome to Imagined Tomorrow. This is the show where we imagine hypothetical futures for India. Futures that could become a reality when science and tech try to solve problems within our uniquely Indian contexts. I'm your host, Shreya. So, how do we climate-proof our homes and neighborhoods? Let's start by taking a short trip to the past. To Chennai.
When I moved into Chennai in 1992, it was not Chennai to start with, it was Madras.
This is Gopikrishna Varier. He's currently the managing editor of the environment news website, Mongabay India. As a veteran environment journalist, Gopi has spent a big chunk of his professional life in Chennai. So he knows the city very intimately. A city that's like many others in India, increasingly feeling the double whammy effects of both climate change and poor city planning.
Madras changed to Chennai in 1996, and it was not just a sense of changing the name of the city, but the whole ethos gradually changed after that.
There were new neighborhoods, new roads, new highways, new IT parks, and new IT corridors. Slowly, the city began to transform.
I mean, it just hastened the face of how Chennai city lost its blues and greens, that is the water bodies and, you know, small forest patches that it had, and it which was replaced or built over with browns, that is the urban buildings.
Now, the city of Chennai, located at the edge of the Bay of Bengal, is not a stranger to rains, storms and floods. It was, after all, built at a vulnerable coastal spot. And the residents have frequently seen heavy downpour and waterlogging. But then came 2015. These rains came in huge bursts in November and December of 2015.
Chennai city confronting its worst crisis after the heaviest rainfall in 100 years.
More than 500 people died, while lakhs of people saw their homes getting damaged.
What happened in 2015 was almost like a once-in-a-century kind of event.
People of Chennai are used to heavy rains and floods, but this one was devastating.
I've been a reporter in Chennai since 1992, and I know every time there's a heavy rainfall, there would be waterlogging in certain areas. Now, I had a mental map. I mean, I knew which are the areas which would flood, which roads should be avoided. And if I had to go on a particular road, which I know would be waterlogged, I take a mental assessment of how deep is the water, because in those days I was driving a scooter and I had to ensure that water doesn't get into the exhaust. So I knew that that height where the water would not get into the scooter. So I could do that.
But the 2015 rains, Gopi says, broke all those mental maps and imageries that he had built as a longtime Chennai resident, and the ones that other residents had built in their minds.
So, I mean, waterlogging is a part of life in Chennai. But now people are scared. I mean, every time there is a heavy rains, people are scared it's going to flood. That fear psychosis has come into the people.
As researchers tell us, for cities on our coasts, like Chennai, climate change will bring more rains, cyclones, and sea level rise. And together, their effects could mean more of these mega flood-like events.
Chennai had big floods once every 10 years. So 2015, you had 2005, 1995. But now the return time is to 2021. So it's from once in 10 years, it's become once in 6 years. So what could become a 1 in 10 year floods can become 1 in 5 years. And what was 1 in 100 year floods can become 1 in 50 years, 1 in 30 years, etc. So the return time of these events are only going to increase.
And each time there's one more record-breaking rain or cyclone or flooding event, it not only gets its own Wikipedia entry, but also tests the resilience of the residents. You know the trope, Spirit of Mumbai whenever there's a flood, or hashtag Chennai floods, where folks on Twitter band together to save stranded Chennai residents. But as we move into a future with more storms and floods 1 year to no rains and severe water shortage in the next, imagine having to bounce back over and over and over again. Resilience then just becomes tiresome. In fact, constantly having to bounce back is already a drain on a lot of people's mental health, their finances, and their ability to live decent lives. How many times can you keep loading all your furniture on the bed and scramble to protect your electronics because floodwater keeps entering your living room? How many times do you keep repairing your roof because it leaks? How many times will you try to walk or ride your bike through a waterlogged road, your heart in your mouth, hoping there's no open pothole and you don't get swept away? So back to the question that's at the core of this episode, which is, how can we climate-proof our neighborhoods and homes? Of course, there's no denying that governments and businesses have to work towards drastically cutting down greenhouse gas emissions. That's the main way of slowing down the worst effects of climate change.
The 1.5 degrees target from the Paris Agreement isn't in sight at all.
But since we have already dumped a whole lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and continue to do so, we have set into motion climate impacts for which we'll have to find out ways of adapting for the long term, with or without the government's efforts. In Chennai, many people realized this after the 2015 floods.
In one way, it's for the good, because it gave a wonderful opportunity for residents of Chennai to, since the administration was missing in action, to innovate and build their own communication networks.
For example, after 2015, private weather forecasters and bloggers became tremendously popular. Like Pradeep John, who goes by the name Tamil Nadu Weatherman on Twitter.
Depression, rare depression.
So many residents started depending on updates from Pradeep and others like him through apps and WhatsApp to know when to expect rain in different parts of Chennai. Some people created crowdsourced maps that would display real-time waterlogged roads. This helped people plan their movements around the city. When should they step out? And what areas were safe and what were not? There was also a rise of citizen groups, Gopi says, who increased efforts to raise awareness about the city's water bodies and development plans.
I'm the mascot for City of Thousand Tanks.
Because they could see how the city's growth was closely linked with climate disasters.
At least the 2015 floods was, in that sense, pardon my pun, watermark for a whole series of people-generated communication innovations, you know, which other cities also took when similar events happened.
The 2015 floods didn't just trigger these early warning resident communication systems. Some people also started actively trying to protect their homes through some very ingenious ways. More on this after a quick break. Welcome back. After the 2015 floods in Chennai, Gopi heard about a rather odd trend in the city, something that he didn't believe at first.
That's quite funny, actually. I mean, I had heard about this, that what they're doing is they're erasing their buildings. And I found this funny. I mean, initially, I did not believe. I thought this was nonsense. There's something like science fiction, raising a building.
Yes, raising a building. Many people were getting their homes lifted above the ground. Not just single-storied homes, but multi-storied buildings, raised sometimes by 6, 7, even 8 feet.
But then I was in touch with Anna University and trying to find out. And they said, yes, it's happening. And there's academic advice being given on this.
So who was raising these buildings? Why and how? Let's tackle the why first. If you have lived through heavy rains, you'll intuitively know that some neighborhoods in your city flood more than the rest. It depends on things like the elevation of your area relative to the others, what all has been built there, what the hydrology of the area is like or how the water flows, and whether the flow of water is blocked for some reason. Maybe the local administration has not unclogged the open drains, or a new building has come up next to yours, blocking the flow of water. In a future world that's going to get wetter, it's a good idea to know how your area behaves. In Chennai, researchers studied the city's neighborhoods after 2015 to see why some areas had been worse off than the others. And they found that places like Velachery, which is a relatively new neighborhood, flooded more than the older parts of the city like Mylapore. And that was because Velachery was built on a network of low-lying wetlands. And when water flows to the area, it stays there for a long time, doing a lot of damage to the homes. But the Velachery residents had another problem.
So I was talking to residents, and one of the reasons that the residents said is very interesting. They said they are forced to do this because they have realized the road in front of the house, every time the government or the corporation went and tarred the road, laid a layer of asphalt on the road kept rising. And the house in relation to the road went lower and lower. So when they started, their house foundation was above the road, but now it's gone below.
The residents were getting frustrated, so they took matters in their own hands. They reached out to building contractors who specialize in lifting and moving existing homes. Yes, it actually happens, and it's quite common, as I found out. I got in touch with one such contractor. His name is Rajesh Kumar Chauhan, and his father started the company MCMD Engineering Works Private Limited way back in the 1990s in Yamunanagar, Haryana. I had a conversation with Rajesh on the phone. The network wasn't great, so I will translate. He says that people call for his building lifting services when there's either persistent waterlogging in their area or when sewer lines are blocked and sewage backs up, entering homes. They also literally move homes, that is, shift houses a few feet away. And they do this in situations like, say, when the road along the house is too narrow and big vehicles like trucks scrape across the walls and gates. But when it comes to lifting buildings higher, waterlogging is a popular reason. Rajesh says that following the 2015 flood, there was so much demand for his building lifting service that he would set out at 5 in the morning and start visiting homes and come back only by night, day after day after day. In his estimate, between 2015 and 2018, companies like his probably lifted some 1,000-odd buildings, he says. You may or may not believe this number, but buildings in Chennai are being lifted up. There are several videos on YouTube as well that you can check out. So, how do people like Rajesh lift buildings? Well, it starts with the contractors completely digging around the foundation of the building. The floor is removed entirely. Then hundreds of jacks are placed under the foundation, like the ones you put under a car when changing tires. Then the workers perform a coordinated dance, turning each jack by a tiny equal amount at the same time. That way, the building lifts higher bit by bit, until it's 3, 5, or 6 feet higher than it was previously. Rajesh says that it can take anything from 30 days to lift a small house to 3 months for a medium-sized building, which can require over 200 jacks. It's a tough job, he says, one that his father and he worked together to standardize. And today, companies like his always seem to have work because problems like waterlogging and not going anywhere. There is something oddly charming about our Jugadu ways of solving problems, like lifting a building with hundreds of jacks. Who would have thought? But that is not going to be enough in our climate uncertain future.
Analysis by the International Energy Agency has estimated that 60% of the floor space that will exist in the year 2040 in India has not yet been constructed.
That is Dr. Siddharth Singh, a researcher who works on climate action and energy transitions. You heard him in part one of this series.
I always tell people to just look around and see the number of houses and the buildings that they see. Now just imagine double of that. That's probably what's going to exist in the year 2040. And within this, 70% of the new construction that will happen is going to happen in urban India. This, of course, is being led not just by economic growth, but also urban population growth specifically. So India is adding the equivalent of 13 Mumbais or about 20 Bangalores to its urban population over the next 2 decades.
We are going to add a ton of buildings to our cities. Just do what Dr. Siddharth suggested. Look out of your window and imagine double of what you see. How will you make all of that climate safe? Well, the problem is that our current ways of constructing homes are not very climate safe either. For instance, most of our homes are not equipped to handle the heat that's going to become pervasive with hotter summers and warmer winters.
Recent trends have shown that households are using more and more of what we call as pakka materials, which is, you know, cement, steel, and so on. So back in 1990, about 75% of urban households and only 55% of rural households used pakka materials. Today, that number is over 95% in both rural and urban census households. Homes, be it in Uttarakhand or in Goa or in Kerala, are all built with nearly the same types of construction material.
There is, of course, comfort in uniformity. You can build quick, cheap, sturdy homes and buildings with concrete, steel, and glass. And many aspire to be able to do this. But while convenient and cheaper, it's not always appropriate for every region's climate, especially heat. Because all of these materials are very good at trapping the sun's heat and keeping it locked in.
What this means is that Indian homes become heat traps and therefore are unable to withstand extreme heat situations, which is a part and parcel of climate change, which of course we'll see more heat waves in certain parts of the country.
And India has been experiencing this since March. Severely hot temperatures everywhere.
Around this time last year, India was in the middle of a terrible heat wave.
So early in the year with such severity.
Many north, central and eastern states were facing temperatures 5 to 9 degrees Celsius above what would otherwise be expected during these months. Bangalore was also feeling the heat, and my office slash bedroom is right under the terrace, so I completely got roasted in those months. Now, scientists predict that India will not only generally become hotter, but that there will be more heat waves, worse heat waves, and heat waves in months and areas that previously haven't seen that much heat. So, Dr. Siddharth says that we will have to think differently for the future.
So, for example, homes that are built to be thermally insulated, which means that they have the appropriate building envelope, appropriate types of glass, which does not absorb a lot of heat from the sun, the use of appropriate materials and other forms of insulation, and also ensuring that there are no gaps between windows and doors.
So for future homes, we will have to start thinking about both the design and orientation of the buildings, but also the materials that go into building them. How much direct sunlight do they all let in? How much gets reflected? For example, how much glass are you using in your windows? And what kind of glass? Because while glass windows let in a lot of light and unfettered views of the outside, glass can also turn rooms into hot greenhouses. Just think of what it feels like when you get into a car parked under the sun for a few hours. But there are specific kinds of glasses that allow the visible part of sunlight to come through while blocking the heating parts of the spectrum. Or consider roofs. Roofs made of concrete tend to soak up the sun's rays during the day, then radiate the heat to the inside in the evenings. One simple solution to this, experts say, is to paint dark concrete roofs white. Or to cover it with things like white mosaic tiles. Basically, paints and materials that reflect much of sun's heating infrared portions.
And related to this is something called the cool roofs policy, because some cities are more susceptible to heat waves, and ensuring that at the policy level, buildings are mandated to have certain types of roofs can ensure that some of these worst extremes or the worst impacts of climate extremes are avoided.
The city of Ahmedabad has one such policy. It started after May 2010, when Ahmedabad was hit by a terrible heat wave. Temperatures reached over 48 degrees Celsius. More than 1,300 people died of heat-related issues. But there was one incident that was particularly catastrophic. One hospital had its neonatal ward, or the unit where newborn babies are treated, on the top floor of the building, right under an old black tar roof. The roof soaked up all the heat and created an oven-like effect in the hospital. And so many newborns died that day. Finally, Ahmedabad pushed out a cool roofs program. One of the things that happened under this program is that roofs of thousands of low-income homes were painted white. Several NGOs also came up with modular cool roofs that many of these homes could put up. So, better insulation, cooler materials, and cool roofs will probably not just shield homes from heat waves, but also lead to lower energy demand. Because more air conditioners is not the solution to heat. Firstly, most people can't afford them. And even if everyone could, running ACs requires energy that comes mostly from burning fossil fuel. Also, an air conditioner takes hot air from the inside and pumps it to the outside. So basically, the technology that makes the insides of our homes cooler makes the outside planet hotter, both in the short and the long term. So that's heat. But what about climate impacts like worse rains, flooding, and cyclones? How can we reimagine homes that are safe from these?
So firstly, we need to ensure that buildings don't obstruct the natural flow of water. A prediction that I've made is that in the future, all buildings and houses in India will be built on stilts, in that the ground floor will not actually be a massive block that obstructs the flow of water in the event of an unexpected flood.
He makes this prediction, he says, because whether your location will flood or not is not just dependent on you, but also on people around you and the administration.
So you could do everything right, but if you know everyone else doesn't do the same thing, you could find that you know drains are blocked and so on, and therefore there's a flood. The once in a 100-year flood happens once every decade, and therefore you know that could cause immense harm. In fact, I have a friend who used to live on the ground floor, and there were massive floods in 2016 or 17, and they pretty much lost everything. And in fact, they had to stand on top of an almira for over a day just to kind of be secure.
Which is why I guess the folks in Chennai have tried to take matters in their own hands by calling the building lifting services.
And related to that is that we need to reconsider the excessive use of glass and other material that could potentially become dangerous in the event of cyclones. So these are the kind of changes that we need to see to our construction to ensure that both climate mitigation and adaptation go hand in hand.
In my view, all of these changes can't be just left to individuals to implement on their own. We would need regulations that mandate that all houses and buildings in India be constructed according to heat-friendly or humidity-friendly, flood-friendly or cyclone-friendly building codes, depending on your location and the kind of future climate trends that area is likely to see. Now, let's assume that all new houses and buildings follow these codes in the future, and that older houses and buildings get retrofitted in ways that make them capable of withstanding extreme temperatures and rain and other weather events. even that is not going to be enough. Because as Dr. Siddharth mentioned briefly, a home is not just about one building or one house. It's also your neighborhood, your neighboring neighborhoods, spaces around you that work together to keep your individual structure safe. So how do we make these neighboring spaces safer? More on that in a bit. Welcome back. Your home is made of neighborhoods. So it helps to know how those neighborhoods have grown.
Indian cities like Mumbai or Bangalore are seeing a lot of climate-induced immigration of people.
This is Dr. Harini Nagendra. She's an ecologist who leads Azim Premji University's Center for Climate Change and Sustainability.
You see, for instance, in Bangalore, places like dry areas like Raichur, etc., parts of Karnataka where it's very difficult to have agriculture. Those kinds of places, people are flooding into cities. And a group that I was working with from Cornell, we did a study on the central Indian forest areas in Madhya Pradesh, areas around Kanha National Park. And from there, the number of people that are moving seasonally, sometimes permanently, into different areas because of climate shocks to their agriculture is enormous.
We heard this in the last episode also, that more and more people, many of whom are marginalized, are moving into cities because they are facing climate change-related hardships, like erratic monsoons affecting agriculture and water.
And this is one of the big ways in which our cities have been growing, our mega cities especially. You know, look at Mumbai, look at Bangalore. And that is growth of a very unplanned nature, especially in the past few decades. So if you look at older growth in Bangalore, for instance, or in Mumbai, it was these relatively planned parts of the city. And that's not to say they were perfectly sustainable. You know, they took away agriculture or farming areas. We don't know about the kinds of compensations they paid farmers. There were other challenges. They built over lakes. So it was not perfect planning by any chance. But there was some planning. You know, you had an idea, for instance, that every place that you built, you would have some open spaces that were designated for parks or for children to play. Or you had some places where people would walk. You had, you know, good sidewalks for walking. The roads were reasonably wide. There was a drainage system in place.
But if you look at the newer part of the city, the periphery, you find a different picture.
Now, if you look at it, the peripheral part of the city, it's outside the urban planning zone, as in it's outside the municipality at least. And it's a free-for-all. So it's almost the worst parts. There is no sewage lines. There's no planning for water. There are large multi-story apartment complexes that have grown, come up. And if you have climate change, you're going to have too much water or too little water. It's not as though the amount of water India gets is going to change drastically. It will, but the more drastic changes are going to come to the fact that, you know, you have very high amount of water suddenly in a very short amount of time. And then you don't have rains for a very long time. And so when you have cities like this, without any lakes, without any wetlands, without any open spaces, without any planning for where the water is going to come from, that's going to be our biggest climate challenge for our cities. Either you're going to have flooding during these times of unseasonal rain because there's nothing to hold the water, it rushes across concrete. You're going to have severe flooding. And the rest of the year you're going to have, or the other years that you don't get rainfall, you're going to have very bad droughts. So that's one part of what's happening to the cities.
The second thing that's happening, she says, is that we are now trapped within this constant maze of a heat island effect, where because we use so much concrete and glass, cities are several degrees hotter than the outskirts or rural areas.
There are estimates for cities which say that because of the combination of concrete and climate change, you have these what you call urban heat island effects. And so Indian cities can be anywhere between 5 to 7 to even 10 degrees hotter than they are in the next 30, 50, 70 years, just because of this combination of urban heat island effects and climate change. Right? I think of what that's going to do to our cities. You know, there's already, I think, one place in Rajasthan where the tar melted 2-3 years ago when it was a heat wave of about 47, 48 degrees. If you have cities where the tar is melting, I mean, seriously, you've shut down the city.
But you don't have to shut down the city because some solutions to this problem are stupidly simple.
We need to replant all those parts of the city that have lost the trees. No, not plant in some distant areas, but wherever the city has lost its trees, we need to have trees back in those areas, especially along the roads, for instance. There are, again, estimates that say that a tree on the road in a city will be 4 to 6 times as effective against climate change and pollution than a tree in the rural areas. On the road is where you have the maximum air pollution. On the road is where you have the maximum heat. So on the road is where, you know, your trees are most needed. Plant massive amounts of trees across Bangalore and all the places we lost trees before.
Plant trees that we are familiar with, she says, like jackfruit, mangoes, tamarind or guava. Trees that children can have fun with. Trees that provide shade and comfort to the people who spend hours outside in the heat. Like hawkers and people who keep our cities functioning. Not postcard trees like palm or manicured hedges of exotic plants in places where they don't grow. Apart from plants, rejuvenate your lakes. Keep the stormwater drains unclogged and let water flow where it should. None of this is rocket science, but somehow our administrators turn a blind eye to them. In fact, given how big a problem climate change is, you might think that cities probably already have some sort of climate change action plan that thinks of all these problems.
We did a study of climate plans in Indian cities. We were able to identify only 13 plans related to climate action. They don't always call themselves climate action. Some call themselves heat action plans. Some call themselves pollution, climate, you know, it's related things. But they deal with climate in some form or the other. And only 13 plans in English. And we did find a cluster of plans in Marathi that we were not able to read. But at least that's nice. That shows that Maharashtra is doing something for the smaller towns. But these 13 plans are so technology focused, you know. For instance, Ahmedabad has put in a very well-regarded heat action plan because people used to die. A lot of people used to die every year because of the heat waves and heat strokes. And so that plan is excellent. But what it doesn't account for is any role, in, for instance, for nature. It's only technology-based. Paint your roofs white, have SMS alerts.
Or have places ready for people to take refuge in, like community shelters, mosques, temples, and libraries.
But when I was talking about the city where the tar melted, if it's going to become even hotter, let's say 5-6 degrees hotter, these systems are not going to be enough. Right? So you need to plant trees to restore waterways, to cool down the city, not just get people out of the heat. That does not seem to be talked about for most cities, you know.
But even with cities that do have some kind of climate action plan, the way they go about approving development projects often feels like everyone is shouting in their own soundproof rooms.
If you look at Mumbai, why are you building a second airport on the Navi Mumbai floodplains and devastating mangroves for that when, you know, your airport will probably come back between 2030 and 2035, by which time the area around the airport is very likely to be flooded. And then if you build a seawall, it's impossible. You know, mangroves are going to be do a far better job of protecting your airport than seawalls can.
In fact, if you really want your neighborhood and city to remain safe from the effects of climate change, there are areas that we will need to leave alone. Like areas right next to the sea. Because scientists have been shouting about sea level rise and about the combined effects of this rise with more cyclones and rains in the future that will devastate large parts of our coastal cities. But real estate prices and our official plans for infrastructure and growth of cities suggest that our scientists, governments, businesses, and residents, all of us see the world very differently.
Not just us. You know, again, I'll tell you another recent study in the US was just looking at areas along the coast and identifying vulnerable populations. And they find that the population that is vulnerable to climate change in the US has hugely increased in the past 15, 20 years. Why is it hugely increased? Not so much because the risk of climate change has increased. Of course, there's that. But the number of people moving into these vulnerable areas have increased. So you're actually building on the coast, you're developing in these vulnerable areas. You know they're going to go down in 10, 15 years, but that's still where your hot property markets are. That's still where prices are going up.
If you think that all of this sounds rather grim, it's because the situation is grim. But what gives me courage is that we have plenty of people who understand the urgency of the climate crisis, of what's coming in the future. People like scientists, journalists, citizen groups, local communities, activists, and the next generation who stand up for our future on this planet, whose actions might seem small and inconsequential today, but could prove to be the difference between a catastrophe and relative normalcy in the future. The only question is if we will listen to them. This episode of Imagined Tomorrow was created and hosted by me, Shreya Das Gupta. Theme music, editing, sound design, and mixing is by Abhijit Shailanath. Thanks to all the experts who spoke to us and shared their thoughts. Dr. Harini Nagendra, Dr. Siddharth Singh, Gopi Krishna Varier, Rajesh Chauhan, Joydeep Gupta, and Neelima Valangi. The third and the last part of this mini-series will be out next week. If you have questions or anything to say to us, do reach out on Twitter or email, which is imaginedtomorrow@gmail.com. That's it for now. Thank you for listening.